This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, July 29th, 2009. From Bogota, Colombia, I'm Manuel Rueda. Coming up in today's program, sectarian violence continues in Nigeria as the army shells a compound belonging to a militant Islamic group. Details emerge on a new healthcare reform proposal in Washington. And we go to the Honduras-Nicaragua border, where tensions simmer between the military and supporters of the ousted president. All these stories and more after this news.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Polls have now closed in Moldova, where voters cast ballots for a new parliament, repeating a process they went through just 3 months ago. In April, charges of vote rigging resulted in violent protests. Last month, the ruling Communist Party dissolved the parliament because the country's political parties couldn't agree on a new president. Within hours of the start of today's election, several Moldovan NGOs released information about alleged irregularities. Miles Ashdown has more from Chisinau.
Several Moldovan NGOs have cited dozens of alleged irregularities at the polls, including people missing from voting lists and verbal attacks on observers. During the April election, opposition parties alleged voter registries included the names of 400,000 people who were dead or living outside of Moldova. About 2.6 million Moldovans are eligible to vote. Meanwhile, authorities in Transnistria, the separatist region in Moldova's southeast, blocked access to a poll and didn't allow election observing in the area. Despite these reported problems, hundreds of thousands of Moldovans did successfully cast their ballots. Sylvia, a 69-year-old school teacher, voted in Chisinau, the country's capital. She declined to provide her last name for privacy and job security reasons, but says she voted for an opposition party, the Democratic Party of Moldova.
I want a prosperous country with democracy, with rights unrestricted. I, as a teacher, want a decent salary. I want decent pensions for those who are retired, and a beautiful future for our children and our grandchildren.
She believes the party will move the country toward a thriving European-style democracy. Miles Ashdown, FSRN, Chisinau.
An exiled Chinese Uyghur activist has come forward claiming that 10,000 people involved in the recent ethnic violence in the Xinjiang region have gone missing. Rabia Kadir, who now lives in the U.S., says the protesters all disappeared in one night, but did not cite the source of her information. Kadir is perhaps the most prominent human rights Uyghur activist and leader of the World Uyghur Congress. She's calling for an international investigation. China claims nearly 200 people died in the early July riots and that 1,200 people have been detained. Yesterday, the government restored some phone and internet service to the region after cutting communication channels following the ethnic clashes. Protests by South Africa's municipal workers against low salaries have entered their third day. Davison Makanga has the latest.
Disgruntled municipal workers have rejected a government offer of a 13% salary increase, vowing to continue their strike until their demand of a 15% increase is met. Thousands of municipal workers spread dirt over major streets of Cape Town and Johannesburg's central business districts. Basic services such as refuse collection, water and transport services have been affected by the strike. Meanwhile, workers in pharmaceutical, paper and chemical industries have called off their week-long strike after settling for a 10% salary increase. And the government also avoided major economic turmoil after mining sector workers resolved their disputes. In addition to the strikes, unrest continues this week in impoverished communities throughout South Africa. President Jacob Zuma has called for the arrest of protesters who resort to violence or property destruction. The country's unemployment rate is nearly 24%. Davidson Makanga, FSRN, Cape Town, South Africa.
In the northern Spanish city of Burgos, a powerful car bomb exploded outside the family quarters of a police barracks early this morning. The blast stripped off the outside walls as high as three stories up. Flying glass and debris injured at least 46 people, including officers and their wives and children. Spanish Interior Minister Alfredo Perez blamed the attack on the Basque separatist group, ETA, but the organization has not claimed responsibility. After months of negotiation and massive cuts, California finally has a signed budget, but not before the governor made more cuts to social programs. FSRN's Kelia Ramirez has the story.
Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger used his line item veto to cut about $500 million more in spending. He said the budget is, quote, kind of like the good, the bad, and the ugly. The ugly referred to his additional cuts that reduced or eliminated programs for babies with developmental disabilities, victims of domestic violence, AIDS patients, seniors, and disabled people. Together, the legislature and the governor cut the Healthy Families Program, which provides health insurance to low-income children, by 46%. Kristen Golden Testa, health director of the Children's Partnership, says this means that almost a million children will lose or be denied coverage.
It's gut-wrenching. This is probably the largest pullback in coverage in the nation. And far from protecting children, the governor seemed to have targeted children in his line item veto.
Democratic legislative leaders questioned the legality of Schwarzenegger's last-minute cuts and vowed to fight them. Kelia Ramirez, Free Speech Radio News.
And that's headlines for Free Speech Radio News. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
Details of another proposal for health care reform are beginning to emerge. A group of senators say they're making progress on the major piece of legislation, and although details are still in flux, the measure doesn't include the central tenet of Democratic proposals, a government-run public option. Instead, it would include a cooperative health system. FSRN's Leanne Caldwell reports.
There appear to be some minor breakthroughs on health care legislation.
There's been some consensus. We have not reached an agreement. You know, we say tentative agreement. You know, maybe sometimes a big T, sometimes a small T.
That was Republican Senator Olympia Snow of Maine. She's a member of the Gang of Six, three Republicans and three Democrats working to hash out a compromise. Many are closely watching this Gang of Six as they could determine what's in the final proposal. Moderate Republicans who actually want constructive health care reform are holding out hope that the committee produces legislation they can support. Representative Mike Castle of Delaware.
The Senate Finance Committee is the best hope here. I think of all these committees, that is by far the one that has the most bipartisan input to it. And that's the reason I believe that they may end up being the salvation of the health care bill.
But liberal Democrats want a government-run health option, and they're concerned that the final bill that's sent to the president won't include a public health insurance program. The central component of the Gang of Six's plan is not a government-run option. Instead, they propose a cooperative to be set up by a newly formed commission. The co-ops would then be run by the members and could be organized within states or regions. Democratic Senator Kent Conrad is a member of the Gang of Six. He gives some examples.
47 states have rural electric cooperatives. Many states have telephone cooperatives. Land O'Lakes is a $9 billion entity. That's a cooperative. Anderson Ace Hardware is a cooperative. True Value is a cooperative. The Associated Press is a cooperative. You know, most people don't think of these entities in that way, but in fact they are cooperatives.
Senator Conrad points to a study that says the co-ops could enroll 12 million people and be the third largest insurer in the country. The biggest selling point for these lawmakers is that it could be cheaper. Democrat Blanche Lincoln of Arkansas.
And the problem is on most of those government plans, there's going to be the necessity for a constant stream of federal dollars. Mm-hmm. And I think that becomes an issue.
The co-op would require federal money to get off the ground, but would eventually be self-sufficient. Critics say the co-ops are likely to produce coverage gaps, leaving people uninsured and with more expensive health care coverage. Paul VandenWalden is a senior fellow at the Center for Budget and Policy Priorities.
The problem is that setting up a new health insurance organization is very difficult, and it's not clear whether these co-ops would actually come into existence, and if they did, how effective they could be in negotiating for lower payment rates and actually being an effective force for consumers.
Independent Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont says he's reluctant to support any proposal that includes a co-op.
I guess you need a strong national program. that's available in 50 states that has the clout to negotiate rates with providers, among other things.
The Gang of Six will continue to meet. They will not commit to finishing a bill before the August recess. Down the corridor in the House of Representatives, their health care stalemate has been broken. The conservative Blue Dog Democrats say they've reached a deal with Democratic leadership and have agreed to let the process continue. Leanne Caldwell, FSRN, Washington, D.C.
On Capitol Hill today, lawmakers are considering the Food Safety Enhancement Act of 2009. Consumer groups say the bill will help increase food safety, but the legislation has its critics, including small and organic farmers. FSRN's Karen Miller has more.
The bill failed. It didn't garner the necessary two-thirds of the House of Representatives to pass. It would have required food companies to increase food safety measures. It also would have expanded Food and Drug Administration inspections and would give the FDA the ability to recall contaminated food. Lawmakers who supported the bill said it was needed to curb recent food illness outbreaks in products such as spinach and peanut butter. Lawmakers who opposed it said there would be costs to big businesses and consumers. Representative Frank Lucas from Oklahoma.
Hundreds of millions of dollars in associated fees represented by a new tax on food production, along with other regulatory burdens, will increase the cost of food for consumers, increasingly force food production out of this country, unfortunately. The vast majority of these provisions, along with new penalties, record-keeping requirements, traceability, country of origin labeling, will do absolutely nothing to prevent foodborne disease outbreaks, but will do plenty to keep the federal bureaucracy busy.
Consumer groups supported the bill. They said more inspections from the FDA were needed. Patty Lavera is assistant director for the consumer group Food and Water Watch.
Right now, plants that make processed foods might go, you know, 8 or 10 years without seeing an FDA inspector. They're just not out there. They don't get out there. And this bill says it does it by what type of food they're making. There's categories of risk, but the riskiest plants would get an inspection at least every 6 months to a year.
Lavera says the bill would have benefited consumers, but there were also many details to be worked out.
This bill sends the FDA in a certain direction, but it doesn't specify what the standards are. And so that's what matters at the end of the day. And so there's a lot more work to be done to make sure those standards are right and that they work for everybody. And so we're going to need everybody to be involved in that.
The bill also included a $500 fee on growers who also process foods. This angered small family and organic farmers. Ferd Hefner is policy director for the National Sustainable Agriculture Coalition.
We believe that it should be a progressive sliding scale fee so that large multinational corporations pay at a higher rate than small scale plants, and that small farmers who also do their own processing on farm, which might be as simple as, you know, putting maple syrup in a can or making grapes into jelly and selling at the local food co-op, instead they have a flat fee so that Cargill or ADM or ConAgra is paying this exact same thing that a rank-and-file farmer who's just selling, you know, maybe a few thousand dollars worth of products to the local food co-op is going to pay.
The act would have also required growers to electronically track the food process from the seller to the retailer. Again, Hefner.
Which is something that, you know, a Walmart or a Cargill, you know, probably can do without too much problems. But again, the problem resides in the fact that small farmers are also part of the mix, and A, most of them aren't going to be able to do electronic filing to begin with, but there's no way that the farmer can know once he or she sells to the first person that they sell to. There's no way that they know what happens to the product after that, so there's in fact no way they can live up to what the bill's requiring them to do.
Lawmakers voted on the bill with limited debate and no amendments. Karen Miller, FSRN, Washington.
In Honduras, interim president Roberto Micheletti says he's not that bothered by the U.S. government revoking the diplomatic visas of several Honduran officials. The State Department also said it's revoking derivative visas for those officials' family members. Meanwhile, ousted President Manuel Zelaya is encouraging his supporters to convene at the Honduras-Nicaraguan border. but the military has set up a blockade there, and since last weekend, hundreds of people have been trapped. Tim Russo reports.
In front of the municipal palace in El Paraíso, the First Lady and her daughter, Pichu, spoke to a crowd of hundreds standing in the rain. Xiomara Castro de Zelaya announced that they would not travel beyond the El Paraíso police and military blockade until all Hondurans are granted their constitutional right to travel freely to the border to greet ousted President Manuel Zelaya.
Today, we were informed that there is a strong police and military roadblock here. They haven't told me that I can't pass. But the judge that accompanies us spoke to the colonel, and he was told that there is no problem for my family to pass, alone. So today, we have been here 5 days in this department. And they are saying that only my family can pass. So I'm telling you that all of you are my family.
At 1:15 a.m. Tuesday in El Paraíso, a group of pro-Micheletti supporters drove in 15 vehicles to the First Lady's hotel, demanding that she leave El Paraíso. At dawn on Tuesday, the First Lady's hotel was surrounded by the military. Major Giron, an official on site, said that the soldiers were there to see that the First Lady be safely escorted to the border in light of threats made by the anti-Zelaya protesters to return to the hotel.
She has authorization she obtained through the Supreme Court, or a competent judge, that she leave for Nicaragua. So we are assuring that she make use of that permission, because last night there was a demonstration in this town.
While the tight security situation continues on the border, the U.S. State Department said it suspended indefinitely the diplomatic visas for 4 representatives of the de facto Micheletti government. From Tegucigalpa, Roberto Micheletti responded on the possible suspension of his own visa to the United States.
I am Honduran, and I want the best for my country. I am well-bred, and I believe that there is no reason that I should humiliate myself in front of any man or God, because I have done everything in my life correctly.
Many are continuing to monitor human rights in the country. The Inter-American Human Rights Commission condemned last weekend's death of 24-year-old Pedro Mendiel in El Paraíso and the continued detentions of anti-coup demonstrators through the use of police roadblocks. Thomas Bolgrad is director of the Finnish Refugee Council and chair of the University of Helsinki Philosophy Department. He's in Honduras as a part of an international human rights monitoring team. He too arrived with his team in El Paraíso Monday and was later denied passage across the border to Nicaragua by the Honduran military.
There's a lot of confusion about what's happening, and it's difficult to sort out, so we try to help a little bit and show that people are concerned. So our focus is on the human rights situation. The rumors you hear gives at least a clear sense that people are frightened. There's a lot of insecurity, there's a lot of mistrust against the current government. There's also mistrust against the information available. People are afraid of speaking in public places. The overall sense is that people are living under great stress. And the main worry is that we see a new soft but very pervasive form of repression emerging.
A second humanitarian caravan was denied access to deliver food and water to people in El Paraíso and the anti-coup demonstrators, many of whom trekked days in order to reach the border. An estimated 150 vehicles were stopped in Ojo de Agua, just 21 miles from Tegucigalpa, before being turned back from the border region. The Honduran Red Cross had organized Sunday's failed attempt to reach El Paraíso with similar aid. Tim Russo, FSRN, El Paraíso, Honduras.
More than 150 women and children fled the compound of Islamic militant Mohamed Yusuf as Nigerian military shelled his base in the northern city of Maiduguri. Yusuf's organization, the Boko Haram, has staged several attacks against police compounds in northern Nigeria since last Sunday. The violence has claimed the lives of more than 300 people, according to Nigerian human rights groups, although government officials claim that most of those killed have been militants. Nigeria's population is evenly split between Christians and Muslims, with the latter dominating the northern regions. Islamic groups have staged attacks against Nigerian security forces in four northeastern states since Sunday. As the fighting continues between the Boko Haram and the Nigerian government, civilians are beginning to get caught in the crossfire. Some 4,000 people have been forced from their homes, according to the Associated Press. The whereabouts of Boko Haram leader Mohamed Yusuf are still unknown. Venezuela froze diplomatic relations with Colombia yesterday, following accusations that Venezuelan weapons had been found in a camp abandoned by Colombia's FARC guerrillas. President Chavez withdrew his ambassador from Colombia, claiming he would not accept more aggression from the neighboring country. Chavez also criticized the Colombian government for its plans to allow the U.S. military to use 5 military bases in Colombia, saying this was a threat to Venezuela's sovereignty. We're on the line now with Larry Burns. He's a former diplomat and Latin America expert, and he directs the Council on Hemispheric Affairs.
In general, I fear that President Chavez tends to be too quick on the draw in terms of recalling ambassadors. You know, that's a once-in-a-lifetime type of thing that you do. He seems to be doing it every fortnight.
Was there a better way to protest, or was there another way to protest Colombian accusations that Venezuelan weapons were found in a FARC camp?
Even if it was true, I don't see it being particularly wise that Uribe would make this an issue at this time. And not, I mean, this was a very widespread issue. It was, he accused President Correa of Ecuador of taking money, campaign funds from the FARC guerrillas in Colombia. He accused the FARC in Venezuela of operating in Colombia, of receiving these 20-year-old Swedish ground-to-ground missiles. It makes it very difficult now to move on. Here we have the United States, which is attempting to rebuild its reputation in Latin America and being placed in a situation where it has to defend Colombia now against these allegations of Venezuelan arms shipments and the charges against Correa. That's going to destabilize Washington's ability to support Honduras, to support the rump government in Honduras, which is not its natural inclinations.
In his speech last night, President Chavez said that Colombia's government is highly irresponsible, and by planning to allow the U.S. to use 5 military bases in Colombia, he says that an increased military presence of the U.S. in Colombia poses a threat to Venezuela's national sovereignty. Why does he see these bases as a threat, and how much of a threat are they, actually?
Now, if you have naval bases, air bases, and a fourth fleet occupying in your naval ports, that's a kind of delicate situation. It certainly could be looked upon by Hugo Chavez as a rather dangerous threat for Venezuela. I'm not assuming that Colombia would attack, but just the fact that there were U.S. major U.S. warships in the area, I think, is an act of intimidation. Also, it very much slows down this building momentum that we had for, first of all, a democratic consensus when it came to Honduras, and also the Obama administration was exceedingly anxious to reform its standing in Latin America, which means distancing itself from the values of the Bush administration.
President Chavez says U.S. bases in Colombia would be a threat to his country, but at the same time he's signing military cooperation agreements with Russia. You know, he recently allowed a Russian ship to conduct a military exercise on Venezuelan waters, and this week he purchased enough tanks and armored vehicles from the Russian government to double Venezuela's inventory. Isn't it unfair, then, to say that Colombia shouldn't make military agreements with the U.S.?
What Russia is doing, Russia and China and India are doing, is they are engaging in commercial deals. They are basically buying and selling. They're very interested in Latin American commodities. They're far more interested in Latin American commodities than they are in Latin America's geopolitical situation.
Now, coming back to the diplomatic crisis, Chavez has twice before removed his ambassador from Colombia, but relations were normalized both times. Yesterday, he threatened to cut trade between both countries and nationalize Colombian companies in Venezuela. How far do you think things could go this time around?
Colombia and Venezuela are very anxious to contain differences between them, crises between them. They obviously don't like each other, but they obviously realize that there's a tremendous need factor here. Colombia needs Venezuela, and Venezuela needs Colombia. And because of this need factor, we have a situation where you have a push-pull, and they invite you in and they push you out at the same time.
That was Larry Burns from the Council on Hemispheric Affairs. And now a commentary from Mumia Abu-Jamal.
The San Francisco 8, no more. It's been 2.5 years since the San Francisco 8 former members of the Black Panther Party, were cast into California jails and threatened with life sentences stemming from the 1971 shooting of a cop. Perhaps the state figured the post-9/11 paranoia and mania would make this an easy case. Perhaps the government thought that because many of the accused were men now of advancing age, decades away from their prime organizing and activist days, it would be an easy hit. The 8 men fought with dignity, principle, and unity. And several weeks ago, charges for 4 of them were dismissed altogether. Ray Boudreau, Richard Brown, Hank Jones, and Harold Taylor. New York's Jaleel Muntakim pled no contest to conspiracy and got time served in San Francisco County Jail, almost 2.5 years with 3 years probation. Herman Bell, another New York former Panther, took a similar deal early in July. One ex-Panther, Francisco Torres, faces a hearing next month where most observers expect all charges to be dropped. Another, John Bowman, died before trial. Another, Richard O'Neill, was cleared pre-trial. From the very beginning, back in the 70s, several of the men were brutally tortured by police in Louisiana to elicit false confessions. The cases were dismissed decades ago on that basis alone. Several years ago, in a statement calling for support of the San Francisco 8, I implored supporters to fight for them now, before they fell into the clutches of the state, instead of after. Many took up that fight, leading to today's victory. From Death Row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
And that wraps it up for today's newscast. You've been listening to Free Speech Radio News. From Bogota, Colombia, I'm Manuel Rueda.